Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience.
Coming to us out of the sky, the familiar voice of radio brings endless hours of entertainment, information, and cheer.
Today's sound is designed to suit you. Entertainment.
Would you like to hear more?
Oh, may we?
Hey, listen, I have a record I want you to play.
What you got, Holmes?
It is a rare, one-of-a-kind original pressing.
I just want to hear the music, that's all.
Is it too complicated to just keep my records in the category, okay? Just put the rock and roll in with the rock and roll. Put the R&B in with the R&B. I mean, you're not going to put Charlie Parker in with the rock and roll, would you?
What does it all mean?
I don't know. Who is Charlie Parker?
Yes!
Sounds, Visuals, and Music Podcast, with an emphasis on jazz, funk, soul, and hip-hop. Welcome back to another episode of Sounds Visual Radio. My name is Justin, and my guest on the podcast this week is DJ Cut Creator. Jay Philpott, also known as DJ Cut Creator, is a true icon of hip-hop culture, a legendary DJ who helped bring hip-hop to the mainstream in the 1980s. Cut Creator rose to fame as the official DJ and close collaborator of LL Cool J, shaping the sound and energy of early Def Jam. Born and raised in Queens, New York, and the son of renowned saxophonist Jack Philpott, music was in his blood from the start. From learning trombone as a kid to spinning on global stages, he helped define the role of the hip-hop DJ for a wider audience, appearing on Soul Train, American Bandstand, and in the classic film, Crush Groove. Whether behind the turntables, in the studio, or on the radio airwaves, DJ Cut Creator's influence runs deep. And today we're diving into a story. All right, let's jump into our conversation with DJ Cut Creator.
I was born and raised in Queens, New York, the Hall of St. August area. My father was a famous musician, playing with greats like Wilson Pickett, Sam and Dave, Isley Brothers, Joe Simon. So I've always been into music. Then in junior high school, well, I started out playing drums in elementary school and little junior high school. Then I went to start playing trombone. And trombone's a cool instrument, you know, but it wasn't, I guess, the sexy instrument of the time. You know, things are changing over. So I pretty much picked up, I started watching these DJs and I kind of fell in love with that. So that's how I started with the DJing thing. But I also was an athlete and had several scholarships and stuff like that. But basically, I love DJing. I follow some DJs and I watch them and I'm like, you know what, I can do that. And eventually in, I guess, 1977, I started DJing. Now, the funny thing with me, when I started DJing, I started DJing the same time I started wrestling. So I was kind of new to DJing and trying to find my niche. I was finding my niche at both things at the same time, to be honest with you, because I didn't start wrestling until the same year as a freshman in high school. So, but wrestling's discipline is way different. So I take everything the same way: wrestling, performing, practicing, even practicing and DJing. You know, I take everything the same way, do everything the same way. Like I used to wrestle, like I was in a match, and I DJed like I was in a show.
In the late 70s, when the DJ scene was really beginning to percolate and funk was giving way to hip-hop, what do you specifically remember seeing or feeling during that major cultural shift?
Instruments got a little played out, and you know, the people were doing more and more block parties, and people were doing more and more parties, and DJ stood out a little bit more. We kind of came out of that disco era into the funk era. Yeah, disco came out, and then funk came in. Then the hip-hop came.
Let's talk for a minute about the days that you were playing block parties and building and carrying your own sound system. What was that grind like?
Oh, yeah, man. The no money time. Where you bought your equipment and then might have made $50 at that. yeah, that was good, man. We, like me and a bunch of guys, my brothers, and we all put our money together, summer job money, and buy speakers. We didn't buy the speakers. We built the speakers, you know, buy a set of turntables. That was a grind because then, remember, you had records. And records, they weren't cheap back then, you know. You know, 45 might be 99 cents, and an album might be, or 12-inch might be $3.99, an album might be $5.99. It wasn't a cheap hobby back then, you know.
And in those early days, what would make a DJ or a sound system really stand out in those early battles?
I think more of the punch, the bass and the punch. Like that guy, DJ Divine, a group called Affinity Machine, they had the Sarah Vegas speakers, the B36s, and that speaker delivered so much of a punch for the R&B and the hip-hop and the funk music. It was awesome. So that's where it really... You tried to get towards that, and we ended up getting a couple of those ourselves, and they were awesome.
So Jay, once you did begin the process of crate digging and building your arsenal of records, what were you looking for mainly? Was it 45s or 12 inches, funk and soul?
I started looking for 45s, because I thought I got to jump on it. Jump on the music because, you know, I'm starting from scratch. So then, you know, I worked and would get, you know, get to 12 inches, and I would look for breaks. I would look for the new hot songs. You know, I still play like Good Times and Love Is a Message and great songs like that. So I was still trying to get the hits, get the breaks, and be economically have enough, you know, in the 45s that I could play to, you know, get the night over.
Well, since we are talking about records here, real quickly, what are some of your favorite classic break records?
Number 5 would be Good Times. Number 4 would be Bounce Gate Roll. Number 3 would be Apache. Number 2 would be Dance to the Drummer's Beat. And number 1 would be Love Is a Message.
Let's talk for a minute about some of your earliest groups, which were called Ebony Sound and Future Sound. What was the vibe and what kind of venues were you playing?
We were playing like rec halls, block parties. Once in a while, we'd play a club. A lot of it was like block parties, rec halls, you know, gyms, that type of stuff, where we didn't really get any money. Those were the beginning days of, you know, really getting into it. So Ebony Sounds, it was funny because I started on my own. No, I started with Ebony Sounds. Excuse me. I started with Ebony Sounds, then went up to my own, and then got with Future Sounds because a lot of those guys kind of broke off. So me and Troy became like, you know, partners in it. And that's how that really started. At that point, remember, I'm still wrestling. Now I'm wrestling. I'm blossoming. I'm doing very good, you know. I'm trying to get a wrestling scholarship. I got schools offering me scholarships. I'm trying to stay focused on that. So one day, you know, I came back and still, you know, I still was DJing kind of part-time. And I met a young man by the name of Todd Smith, which everybody knows as LL Cool J, and kind of put him on. And the next thing I know, he ended up getting a record deal and wanted me to DJ for him. Technically, let's go back a little bit. He wanted me to be his road manager. And then a lot of people don't know this. I'm not the original cut creator. A lot of people, there was a guy by the name of Philip, I forgot his last name, but he was cut creator Philly Phil. So the first show we ever did, myself and LL, we brought him, and I did routines with him where he was kind of this guy, Phil. He was kind of like not on point, if I could say that nicely. He wasn't on point, and LL just said, you know what? You just be cut creator. Your name's Phil Pot anyway. So, and that's, making a long story short, that's how that happened. 1983.
You and LL had grown up a few blocks apart, and is it right that you originally met him at a block party on Jordan Street?
What is Jordan? Yeah. Yep, man, yeah, you're right. And he said, yo, man, I can really rap. Let me rap. His mom used to bring him, because he used to get in trouble a lot. So his mom brought him, and he was like, always, he was so eager to play, I mean, to rap. And I'm like, nah, you know. So one day I just gave in, and I gave in, and he let him rap, and everybody was like, oh, crap, this guy's good. You know, this young kid is good. And that's how it all started. His words use and everything at that age was awesome, man. It's like, wow, it was better than a lot of the older guys.
So LL's working really hard, writing these incredible rhymes, sending out his own tapes by himself. What was it like when you found out that he had landed a deal with Rick Rubin and Def Jam?
I didn't believe him. I didn't believe him. I just thought he was pulling my leg, per se. And but when he got it, he bought the record, the test pressing it, and I was like, oh, okay. And I remember going down, getting on the train, going to the city, and meeting Rick, going to Rick's dorm room and everything, and I was like, what is this, you know?
What happened with Jay Philpott, my man, Cut Creator, Philpott used to come by, and he wanted me to rap at a block party because he liked my skills, but I told him, yo, you got to ask my grandma, man, because I was like 13, 14. He was like, all right, so he go and ask my grandmother, and you better not let him get in trouble. You better watch out for him. She gives him, reads him the riot act. Okay. But yeah, Philpott used to take me to the parties, and you know, that's my man, you know what I'm saying? I love Jay. And it's funny because I remember when I was working, trying to get the record deal, and I finally got in contact with Rick Rubin. I used to tell Jay Philpott, yo, I got this guy, Rick Rubin, and gonna go down and, you know, he wants me to make a record and this and that. And they used to always think I was lying. It was the craziest thing. Philpott was like, yo, man, don't have me going down here and you lying. Because they used to think I exaggerated.
Yeah, it was awesome to hear it. But the real kicking point was to hearing it on Red Alert's show. It was a Saturday night, one of the Master Mix shows. And to hear it on the radio, that was the real, like, wow, you know. It took off in the tri-state area pretty quick. But I think the real turning point, when he had the record and we were going back home on a train, and he stared at the record, like maybe a good, you know, whatever, the train ride, 40 minutes. He just was staring at it. And I kind of stared at it myself. I was like, wow, this is awesome. My radio, believe me, I like it loud. I'm the man with the box that can rock the crowd. Walking down the street to the hardcore beat while my JVC vibrates the concrete. I'm sorry if you can't understand, but I need a radio inside my hand. Don't mean to offend other citizens, but I kick my fire way past 10. My story is rough, my neighborhood is tough, but I still sport gold and I'm out to crush. My name is Cool J, I devastate the show, but I couldn't survive without my radio.
Let's talk for a minute about LL's first professional debut performance at Manhattan Center High School. What was the energy in the room like that day?
Yeah, that was funny. That was a school. Okay, let me just start back. Our first gig, Manhattan Center, I think it was 116, the old Benjamin High School, Benjamin Franklin High School, on 116th Street in, I think, East River Parkway. All right, I drove I had a 78 Grand Prix, so we're driving, everything's in the car. So we get across maybe 3rd Avenue, 116th Street, my car breaks down. The ball joint falls off, the ball joint. So I had to leave my car there, and we walk, carry the turntables, everything to the school. And we get there, and it's like just lunchroom tables is a stage. Maybe about 8 lunchroom tables is a stage. And I'm trying to get this stuff together, but worried about my car and trying to get a tow truck driver. And LL said, man, forget your car. I'm like, yo, that's my car, you know, out in Harlem, East Harlem. So, but going into the Manhattan Center, we were like, this is just a schoolyard, no stage. It was our first show. And it was great. A bunch of young kids. It was us, Tila Rock and Jazzy J, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the late Andre Harrell. But it was an awesome show. We went on first and did our 3 songs and on the lunchroom table, signing autographs. It was the first time we ever signed autographs. But in the back of my mind, I was worried about my car still in the middle of the street in Harlem. So that was LL used to like crack jokes, man, forget your car. You know, but you know, and all in all, it was cool.
When Rock the Bells came together in the studio, did it feel like a hit right away to you?
Well, now you got to go back a little bit. And you got to go back to the movie Crush Groove. Because the movie Crush Groove really set everything off. So when I Want You and Rock the Bells came out, it was just on. Because remember, when radio came out, we did the movie Crush Groove. It skyrocketed. Not a lot. But then when we put out Rock the Bells, that was ridiculous. That's how that kind of the movie Crush Groove really catapulted Rock the Bells. After the movie Crush Groove, the demand started getting high. Instead of us getting $500 show, guys, we were getting $2,000, $2,500. The money started going. I remember playing in Philadelphia and getting chased by women in cars and stuff like that. And I was like, what's going on here? And that was the real turning point. Like, oh, we're onto something now. Carloads of women following us. You know, we had to get over the Ben Franklin Bridge, you know, to get out of harm's way and stuff. But that's the real turning point.
Can you share some memories or stories about those first tours that you and LL did with Run DMC, the Beastie Boys, and Houdini?
I think that was the best touring days ever. Because a lot of times what we would do is we were so much close-knit, us and Run and Houdini. A lot of times everybody think it was wild. We weren't really wild. What we used to do a lot of times is rent gymnasiums and play basketball all night after getting 40 ounces of beer and just drinking and playing basketball. That was what we really did after concerts. No, you know, it wasn't wild and, you know, girls, you know, there was girls, but it wasn't crazy like you think it was. So those were the days. And, you know, we were so much friends, like, you know, Ron will ride on my bus. I'll ride with Jam Master Jay, you know, talking with him. He said, man, you know, one thing he's always said, yo, just don't try to be me. Don't try to be Drew, which is Grandmaster D. Don't try to be yourself and do the best you can do the best way you can do it, the best way you are. Don't try to be like no one else. And I took that to I took that all my career. Don't try to be like, you know, a bobcat or anybody like that. Just be you. Do what you do best. The Raising Hell Tour was our first tour, period, major tour. And it was like family. It was like family. I would lie to you and say there wasn't no competition because everybody wanted to be friendly in a friendly way. Oh, we're going to bust your ass tonight. You know, that's what we like Houdini had Memphis. LL had Philadelphia. Run might have had DC, you know, and we'd be like, oh, we're going to get y'all tonight, you know, just jokingly. But it was a friendly competition. Grandmaster D or a few of us will just ride on our bus. See, we're going four hours away or something. You know, we'll get on the bus that morning, just talk and ride. And Jam Master Jay was my biggest influencer when I, you know, became professional, per se. His realm is a new horizon of cuts. They expand from his hand as he conducts. Aim a lot of cool project, not photography. Co-creator Billy Fields biography. The lyrical virtuoso makes his return. All adversaries should be concerned. LL2J is back again. Allow me to introduce you to my friend, Cut Creator. His circumcised DJs when he's on the airwaves. Till the mission's complete, you're a musical slave. In his division, he'll endure any collision like a surgeon with a scalpel to make an incision. As for me, I'll annihilate, exile, and communicate you from rapping. And my lyrics are the best. Go down the rap, but not the subject matter. All you sucker DJs will scatter. Cut Creator will employ techniques that will absorb Toy Boy. Hurry up above Cut. Cut Creator is his name. The boy's so nice, my focus was strange. You can rearrange, but you don't have the brain to arrange scratch patterns full of audio chains.
How much of those early live performances were improvised versus rehearsed?
It was a lot improvised, mostly improvised in the beginning. Then I remember we got with this choreographer. Russell had hooked us up with this choreographer, and it really showed me how to put stuff together. It was a female, too. I forgot. I can't remember her name. I see her face. And she put some stuff together, and you know, with Run and Curtis and the Fat Boys and Houdini, watching their shows, we like, okay, we see how you have to do this now. You just can't play like you're playing at block parties. You know, you have to really put a show together.
The one thing I neglected to say when I showed this album before, and we'll take care of that right now, this album is gold. Hold on to that for me, will you? How are you?
How's it going?
Real well. Introduce me to your friends, will you? The gentleman over here.
And this is DJ Cut Creator, my one-man band.
How are you? Nice to see you. When you were a little bitty kid, your grandfather gave you your stuff to start you off in business. What were you going to do before you became a musician?
I wanted to play football.
But, you ever sorry you gave it up?
No. I'm on bandstand.
Yeah! Thank you, sir. LL, it's nice to have you. Thank you so very, very much.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, gonna what? Around the clock. 3 years ago in St. Albans, Queens, I was rocking at a bar called 118. Little kids stood and watched as I rocked the spot. Didn't know years later I'd be standing on top. Little Farmers Boulevard, I was born in Bayshore. Stop the rich and shake hands with the poor. And this is a story about a brother.
And you and LL got to perform on some iconic television shows like American Bandstand and Soul Train. What was doing Soul Train like?
It was small. On TV, it looked so big, but it was so small. And it was cool. It was like, wow, that's the Scramble Board, and that's Don Cornelius host over there, and that's this dancer, and it was cool, though. But my first thought was, wow, this place is small.
How did the creative energy shift when L.A. Posse and Bobcat came on board for LL's second record, Bigger and Deafer?
That was a little different, not knowing these guys. And, I was kind of like there, but not really there, if that makes sense. I was just kind of seeing what they were doing. And because remember, that kind of was new with me too, production. So I didn't know, a lot of it. And, trying to learn, to be honest with you, really just trying to learn. And, but they did an awesome job. And we became family and friends. You know, me and Bobcat still are close right now. We talk and have a good time. But it still was a learning experience for me, because I remember I'm kind of behind a little bit. I don't want to say, I was a little slower in learning than everybody else. We probably would have made 100 albums if we had the technology now. You know, you're talking about recording a 2-inch tape, and you're talking about starting at 8 o'clock at night to 6 or 7 in the morning. It was like a full-time job. You know, nowadays you could probably get over it in, an hour. So it was always fun.
You were in the unique position of being LL's DJ as well as his road manager for those early gigs. Was it ever hard for you to balance the business and the creative side?
No. I was always up for challenges and stuff. You know, I would deal with everything, get all the paperwork together, know my hotels and everything, speak to the promoter. Only thing was, for about 30, 45 minutes, I just had to take that hat off and DJ. But after I took that hat off, I was back into the road managing form. I was always a step back type of guy. I always was like that. I always was, sit back. I didn't need the hoopla or nothing. I didn't need to be in the forefront. I was always that type of guy. And wrestling and baseball, basketball, whatever I played, football. I always was the guy to get the job done without the hoopla.
What do you think has been your most underappreciated contribution to LL's legacy?
I honestly think it goes to the shows, the live shows. I think my biggest contribution is help putting his show together. We're so tight, he didn't even have to worry about anything. A lot of people call me a DJ, but I call myself a musical director. And I think that's my biggest contribution to him.
So when the collaboration between you and LL effectively ended around the release of Bigger and Deafer in 1987, was that difficult for you?
To be honest with you, LL was always a soloist, but I've been with him since 12 years old, so it hurt. I'm not going to say it did not hurt. It hurt. But it also was reality and a wake-up call. And, you know, I was bitter for a little bit. I don't know if there'll ever be a chance to reunite. Well, you did on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I don't know. I mean, only God knows. So I can't really say anything. But, I mean, I'm actually cool with him. I'm happy for him. I'm happy for all his achievements. But it's also a time for me to do my thing, because a lot of times you get caught up in somebody else's work, you don't get into your work. If that makes sense to you. I feel like, wow, I put all that time and effort into that, but didn't really put enough time and effort into my stuff.
Jay, let's talk about the craft and culture of DJing for a minute. In the 80s, when you were with LL, the DJ was really kind of the heartbeat. How do you think that role has changed and evolved in today's hip hop?
Oh, yeah. It's funny that you said that. I spoke to LL maybe 2-3 nights ago, and I said to ask him the same exact question. I said, I remember that was the fun of it, you know, scratching two records and you know, when an MC rapped on it. And I said, man, that's the fun. That was the fun part of DJing. And where did that go? And he was like, you know, now guys, they didn't take the culture and keep moving with it. They just kind of made it simpler. And the DJ kind of faded. When they started doing that, the DJ started fading out. You know, guys get instant replays and it's no showmanship in it no more. And I think it started weeding out.
What kind of gear were you using back in the day? And what's your take on tools like Serato and controllers for DJs these days?
Okay, back then, the first set of turntables I bought was a Technics 210. Then when I got with LL and the deal came, we got two Technic 1200s, the earlier models, and a GLI mixer, GLI 7000 mixer. And the only reason why I got that mixer is because Jam Master J had it. I think Jam Master J had the 9000, I had the 7000. And that's the one we would box up and take, you know, on the road with us, with the cases and everything. And they were workhorses. But now, the way technology and controllers are, I mean, it evolves like night and day. When I last DJ with LL, I still had 1200s and, Rain Mixer. I would use a Rain Mixer, you know, my Serato and everything. But now, with the controllers, for guys like me, I love it. I honestly love it. I think the controllers are one of the best things out there because it doesn't wear on my back. I don't have to bring 1,000 crates of records. It's made it convenient, to be honest with you. And it's also made it, now the flip side of it, of it is that it made it convenient for other guys too, the non-DJs that's trying to DJ, where they didn't have to buy records and stuff like that.
Jay, what do you think is a, for lack of a better word, vinyl era skill that every digital DJ should have to learn?
How to mix without looking at the BPMs. I think every DJ that's on controllers and should know how to mix without looking at BPM, just knowing the music in your library. A lot of people don't mix two songs anymore. You could say Good Times is 112 BPMs and a song like Rock Skate Rolls 111 BPMs, how to match them up without even looking at your BPM matcher, your waveform, I should say.
Jay, you've seen hip-hop evolve from the era of street tapes and MC battles to global stages. What part of that evolution are you proudest to have witnessed firsthand?
I guess the acceptance of like these festivals and stuff playing. And I remember one night we played with Lynyrd Skynyrd. I'm more proud, like when we played festivals and we played with Lynyrd Skynyrd and LL Cool J, that and to see the people really enjoying it, I was like, that's awesome. You know, I would never thought I would play with somebody like that, you know, or guys like, or even be on the same stage as Michael Jackson. You know, those are iconic times for me where, well, we got to leave, you know, like our road manager, we got to leave. No, I want to see these guys, you know, that's the perks of doing this. You know, I want to be able to see some of my heroes and some of the people I saw on TV and heard their records, you know, that was amazing to me.
You were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2021, which cemented your legendary status as a DJ. What did that moment mean to you personally?
Oh man, it was beautiful. It was a real surreal moment. It was so surreal because I think I went to rehearsal in LA, and you know we practiced it, you know, the little show. Then we got to Cleveland. And we're in the stadium, and I'm just like, wow, this is surreal with the lights and the band and all that. It was surreal then. And then when it really, really hit me, is when they had a video before we played. Next thing you know, it was time to go. You know, it's time to hit. That was a surreal moment. I mean, my legs, I had this, what's it called, a little shake in my leg. Like, were you nervous? Yeah, that was surreal because you're thinking about Eric Clapton and all these people sitting there watching you. But seeing all those guys and, you know, Jennifer Hudson and Dave Chappelle and all these people backstage, it was crazy. Beautiful thing. It was a beautiful thing.
Jay, after all you've done and accomplished, block parties and world tours, being such an integral part of the history of hip hop, what still drives you after all this time to DJ and create music?
Well, what keeps me motivated and still have fire in the furnace is my drive is just the love of music. I love to entertain. I love to make people happy, and I enjoy it so much.
Jay, if you could pass the mic to your younger self for one piece of advice, what would you say?
Learn the business a little bit more. Learn the business a little bit more, stay focused a little more, and really dig deep and stop letting outside influences. And what I mean by that is women and all kind of crazy stuff, friends, and, you know, stay focused and, you know, and learn as much as you can about the business.
Cut Creator with me on Sounds Visual Radio. Jay, thanks so much, man. It was nice to talk to you, and I wish you all the best.
No problem, man. I appreciate you. Thank you.
Sounds Visual Radio is a production of Sounds Visual Media. All past episodes can be found in the archive at soundsvisualradio.com. Follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Sounds Visual Media. You can also email the show at soundsvisualradio@gmail.com.